Hi, this is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. Chances are either you or somebody you know has been trying to figure out how to care for and teach their child amid the pandemic. After all, in April of this year, 91% of the world's students were affected by school closures. Per UNESCO, some 160 million students in Latin America had stopped having in-person classes in May. As we'll hear, that means an education cost. As well as children losing the safe havens and nutrition that schools provide. In this episode, my colleague Luisa Lemmy speaks to two experts on the educational challenges now, as well as in a post-pandemic world, and how the region might emerge stronger by using the new techniques that have come to light. Our conversation begins with Emiliana Vegas, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center for Universal Education at Brookings Institution.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Emiliana Vegas, thank you so much for participating in our podcast, Latin America in Focus, today. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start talking about, you know, the challenges of education in Latin America. They didn't come just with the pandemic. They just didn't happen because of coronavirus. And you've been studying education in the region and in the world, with first with the IDB and now with the Brookings Institution. You have an extensive knowledge of what were the challenges for basic education in Latin America before the pandemic. And if you can talk a little bit about that and explain, how did COVID-19 change this context?
Well, thank you. That's actually a very good question. So prior to the pandemic, Latin America and the Caribbean had made quite a lot of progress in what we call access to education, meaning that a great majority of our children of primary age were in primary schools, close to 100%. And access to secondary education had also grown in a majority of countries to quite a lot of rates. Even higher education was expanding. There were two challenges that were at the time prior to COVID front and center for analysts like me and for people who were working to improve education opportunities in the region. One was that the children and the youth in our schools were not learning the basic skills they needed or the advanced skills that today's, you know, societies are calling for. And this we knew because of international and regional assessments of student learning that showed that our students in Latin America and Caribbean countries were underperforming compared to their peers in other parts of the world, especially, you know, their peers in China and Singapore and Korea, Asia, also Finland. But even countries that perform around the average of, you know, all countries in the world, like the United States. So there is a big concern that, you know, on average, our students are underperforming by a lot. In some countries like the Dominican Republic, 80% of 15-year-olds who are in school, who are not, of course, 100% of 15-year-olds are not in school in the Dominican Republic, but 80% of them were not achieving the basic levels of math and language and science knowledge that, for example, the program in International Student Assessment run by the OECD measures.
Just to have some people in the audience to recognize that, that's the PISA score.
The PISA exam, exactly. And so in the last PISA, which was in 2018, there were about 70 countries that participated, and the Dominican Republic was 70th in the ranking with a very high proportion, as I was saying, 80% of students not achieving basic levels. And all of our countries were in the bottom third of the countries that participated. So So that's number one. The second concerning issue was that it is still, of course, even more so after COVID, that we had high levels of inequality in learning outcomes, and primarily driven by socioeconomic status of the family where the student resides. So poor students in our region were even at more disadvantaged than than the wealthier students. And one thing that I like to remind when I would present to audiences in Latin America who often felt and argued that while on average we weren't performing well, we did have some excellent schools, mainly private schools serving the more advantaged socioeconomically speaking students. The reality was that even those students who were in those, you know, high-performing private schools in Latin America were underperforming relative to, say, students from poor backgrounds in Singapore. So, you know, we really don't have or didn't have prior to COVID a lot of excellence in education. So that was prior to COVID. Now that we have COVID, there are so many issues that, are of great concern. Of course, COVID has caused many students to miss out on going to school. So, and, the school closures that have resulted from COVID have meant that students who don't have access to, for example, remote learning opportunities, digital technology, are at disadvantage. But even students who who are in systems that are providing these opportunities, the evidence shows that it's a poor substitute for in-person instruction. So we see, that quality is going to suffer on average.
Why is that? This debate also has happened with more developed or high-income countries when on digital, right? They said, the education is never going to be the same. It's irreplaceable to actually go to school. But why is the impact in Latin America, let's say, more severe?
It's for several reasons. One is that for a lot of students in the region, schools do more for them than provide learning opportunities. Our schools in many countries are the main, sometimes the only source of nutrition for some of the students, are a place where students are safe in a community, where when they live in communities that might be filled with violence or even homes that have violence. So there's a lot that schools do for students and for families, frankly, because they also allow parents to go out and earn a living while their children are safe. That the COVID-19 has caused a huge disruption in. And in our region, I think compared to other regions, particularly developing regions of the world, we had made more progress really in expanding schooling and expanding access and getting more kids to school. So to some extent, this is a bigger hit on our region than in, let's say, Sub-Saharan Africa, where there were still, fighting in many countries to get the access problem resolved.
One of the works that I read, written by you during the pandemic, you pointed out that less than 25% of low-income countries provide remote learning at all, and then only 36% of low-income countries have access to the internet. So how are we measuring all this impact?
What economists kind of believe, and the whole economic profession argues, is that in general, wages on average reflect the productivity of the workers, right? And so our country's economy and wealth and progress is measured by productivity, by how much we produce in goods and services, and that's translated into dollar terms. I would say the consistent estimate of several of us who have done this work is that the COVID-related learning losses due to the school closures will result in losses in productivity worldwide that range between $10 trillion and $15 trillion. So worldwide, it's a huge setback.
Can we get governments in the region to invest in education at all at this time? And maybe in your research, what they have been doing now to respond to that?
Our countries in Latin America had been steadily investing more in education in the last decade. There was a lot of consensus that, you had to invest a certain minimum some would say 4.6% of GDP on education in a country. And many countries were striving to achieve that and had actually achieved that. There were two challenges. One was that the spending wasn't always, well spent. Let's say that investment didn't always go to where it was most needed. There was what economists call leakage. So some of it being lost due to corruption, frankly. And at the beginning, we were talking about how our learning outcomes weren't high. They weren't growing. Our inequality was high. But at the same time, spending was growing. And so there was an effort being made to prioritize education within governmental budgets and as societies as a whole. What we're seeing due to COVID is also unprecedented in that we do have a health pandemic. So there is a need to invest in health systems that are also fairly weak in our region. And, you know, when you're faced with learning losses, we call it a silent crisis. It has huge impacts, but they're not as visible as, you know, mortality rates. And so the competition is tough. However, we are seeing some countries that are at least in nominal terms, continuing to prioritize education. I recently learned that Peru, in its most recent budget, raised nominally the, you know, share of government budget going to education by 4%. But on the other hand, you have countries like Chile, where they had historically been huge supporters of education and investors in education. And in the recent budget that was approved by Parliament and proposed by government, education is for the first time one of the sectors that is not increased. And, you know, I would say it's a hard thing because the reality is that there is a fiscal crisis that's resulting from a health crisis. And governments are going to be very constrained. And I think part of the explanation as to why we don't see the returns to the investment is that governments have also been very investing in education in issues that are very visible and have perhaps results political returns in the short term. For example, you know, building schools, providing laptops, providing materials, but not necessarily in those reforms that really require a lot of investment and are harder to measure or to get the returns in a short term. For example, improving the attractiveness of the teaching profession to very highly qualified individuals and making it a much more attractive profession, really training well teachers, supporting them, paying them well. So all these things take resources, but also take more effort and time to yield results.
I have read an article in The Atlantic that compared, let's say, the stimulus package that the United Kingdom decided to apply, deploying millions and millions on infrastructure, and saying that if this same amount of money was deployed for universal childcare or basic education, that you would probably employ more people and that you will have a greater impact on the economy and you'll be able to employ more women and more families. Is there an argument here of for multilaterals or for lending institutions like the World Bank, like the IMF, that they should be taking a look at education sector more than other alternatives, let's say, that what they have done before with countries in need?
Yes, absolutely. I think that one of the lessons that we also have from countries that have made rapid progress from being, let's say, low or middle income to being a high income country is that they have invested in their people. They've invested in education, in skills, in preparing people for the jobs that they have and for the jobs of the future, helping them innovate and adapt. Countries like Finland, like South Korea, like Singapore, those countries were not necessarily any more wealthy than the average Latin American country, you know, in the mid 20th century. And today, you know, they have very high levels of income and much lower levels of inequality than do Latin American and Caribbean countries. And their recipe was really investing in human capital. They didn't have any necessarily natural resources like oil and you know, other grains that many of our countries have to export. And I do hope that multilateral institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, the bilateral banks will prioritize education and will really almost make it a requirement that all countries now in particular invest more in education than before. And like you were saying, in childcare.
One organization supporting educational projects in the region is the Tinker Foundation. Here's Luisa speaking with its president, Caroline Cronley, who will give us a few examples of what those investments look like.
Caroline, I would like to ask you a few questions. Like, my main interest in talking to you is because you, in your work at the Tinker Foundation, has been getting to know several projects or responses all across Latin America in relation to the pandemic and education. From your perspective, what have you been seeing on the ground?
Yeah, well, Tinker is a foundation based in New York City that has been funding in Latin America for decades and for over 10 years in the area of education in particular. So when we saw schools starting to close due to the pandemic earlier this spring, we knew that this would present real challenges for teachers and students in the region. And then upon some further research, we realized that past experience has shown that these kinds of interruptions in schooling can have really catastrophic effects, both in terms of learning losses and then also increased dropout. So we asked ourselves how Tinker could help try to avoid those more serious consequences, and decided this past June to put out a special call for applications looking for innovative, evidence-based approaches from across Latin America to trying to ensure that students could stay connected to learning, especially those, you know, perhaps without consistent access to internet and devices that have become such a common part of remote learning for so many of us now. And so we saw an incredible response to that call for applications, more than 500 responses, which I think just shows how much activity and interest there is in this important issue across the region. And I think we now have a much better sense of what some of the different strategies are that both civil society organizations and also governments and private sector actors are pursuing to try to make sure that children can continue learning even with schools closed.
Were all the applicants requested to be using technology to come up with an answer or no?
We really wanted to leave that open because one of our objectives for this was to understand just the diversity of different approaches that were being used. And we also recognized that, you know, the region, of course, encompasses so many different contexts that we didn't want to presuppose any one approach would be the right one. Certainly a number of the responses we got did use technology in creative ways, everything from WhatsApp and Instagram to, you know, I guess maybe more old school learning technologies like television and radio for students in more remote areas or without internet access. But we also saw some really interesting approaches targeted at communities and students where, you know, frankly, there's just very little access to technology of any kind. So, in fact, one of the projects that we're supporting in the Amazonas region of Peru relies in part on letters being delivered by boat between teachers and students to make sure that students still feel connected to their educators, even though they're not seeing them in school every day.
Do you have any notion of like how many children or how much of the population do not have access to online remote learning of any kind?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take an example of a country like Colombia, where obviously there's extensive access to internet and use of technology in many facets of life. And nevertheless, a study earlier this year found that, you know, around 2/3 of municipalities across Colombia did not have the sort of infrastructure in place for internet-based learning to be viable for most students. So, you know, I think we see a real disconnect between the ideal of technology-enabled learning and the reality on the ground for many students and also for many teachers, because, you know, access to internet, access to devices is also an issue for teachers as well who may not have those tools in their homes.
Let's jump on the projects or the initiatives that you have seen. What has been civil society response to COVID-19 when it came to schools?
So one thing that we noted is some really exciting partnerships between, for example, ministries of education and nonprofit organizations with expertise. Two examples come to mind in both Peru and Panama, for example. The ministries of education have rolled out really thoughtful television and radio-based learning strategies meant to reach, you know, precisely this large population of students who don't have reliable access to internet-based learning. And so those ministers of education have now looked toward civil society for expertise in developing engaging creative content that will really keep kids learning during this time period. And so we're excited to support those kind of partnerships that bring sort of all of the technical capability and creativity of civil society and match it with the scale potential and reach of governments. I think, another common theme that we're seeing in terms of where civil society is focusing is really in terms of trying to reach and address the learning needs of the most vulnerable students. So understanding, you know, what are the specific interventions now and once schools reopen that are going to be necessary to get kids back on track. One of the things that we've seen in past crises that have interrupted schooling, so for example, you know, the Pakistan earthquake a number of years ago, was that the learning losses actually don't stop once the doors of school reopen. Sometimes children can get so far behind that it's just really hard for them to catch up even once they're back in the classroom. So we're supporting some specific activities, for example, an organization in Chile that's doing really intensive literacy education to make sure that kids are ready to both learn to read and read to learn once they're back in the classroom. Another project in Mexico is working on equipping teachers with new kinds of assessment tools so that they understand where each child who walks into the classroom is in terms of their learning and can customize interventions that really help address the specific needs of each student. That's a real shift in approach, from a more traditional model of the teacher standing at the front of the classroom and delivering content in a uniform way to a group of students. Much more customized, much more responsive to the individual, you know, needs and skills of the learner.
That's super interesting. That takes me to my last question to you. It's just that, do you see in this response, in this project, we talked about it and I talked about it in the other interview as well with Emiliana, about like this new shift on how people can perceive education and the role of schools and society in general, and how parents now, because, you know, everything is also on them to guarantee their kids to enjoy any type of remote learning that is available to them, can be more involved now with the quality of education that is being provided in their countries. Do you see projects or initiatives now that would be able to innovate or be carried out post-pandemic that would help Latin America catch up on this delay, not only the delay caused by the pandemic, but the delay that, you know, the region is behind other countries when it comes to educational performance?
I definitely don't want to minimize the severity of the learning crisis that's been created by the pandemic and the challenges that already existed in many places in Latin America around access to education and quality of education. But that said, I think you're right, Louisa. I think the pandemic really does provide us an opportunity to learn from the changes that have been sort of forced on all of us because of the closure of schools. And absolutely, I think one potential silver lining is the engagement of parents in their children's education. You know, and all of us who have children, right, have suddenly found ourselves, you know, very near to our children's learning, understanding what they're struggling with, what they're great at, what excites them. And I think I hope, and frankly, many many officials and ministries of education across the Americas hope that this will create a new kind of engagement from parents in their children's learning. One specific project, for example, that we've invested in that really builds on that idea is with an organization called Motete in the Chocó region of Colombia. And they are, for example, using Afro-Colombian cultural traditions to get children excited about literacy. And not just reaching out to students and teachers, but also to parents to be part of that process of fostering children's love of reading. And I think those kinds of interventions have a tremendous amount of potential, and even more so now that parents are so much more aware of what's going on with their children's education. I think the other silver lining is that all of us who have been trying to teach our children at home now appreciate even more the skill and sort of special characteristics that are involved in being a good teacher. And I certainly hope that, you know, coming out of this experience in all of our countries, we value teachers more, we listen to them more about what's right for students, and we invest in their own professional development and success, since that will only have positive benefits on children in the region as well.
We're starting to talk about silver linings inside this crisis and what would be the opportunities inside a pandemic like this that has caused such a severe impact, but also has forced remote learning to happen, has forced teachers to deal with technology to do that work. In your research, you've talked about powered up schools. Can you explain what is a powered up school?
Thank you for that. Well, you know what we think of as a powered up school. It's a school that both provides opportunities for students to learn, but also recognizes that learning takes place outside of school, and where each student is, met at the level at which they are. The need to do remote education, to use technology as a way of providing education, has disadvantages, but one advantage it has is that it can allow for a much more personalized education where each child is sort of progressing at their own pace. The teacher is not teaching at the same time the same thing to a large group of students, but rather is, supervising, mentoring, encouraging students to learn on their own. And so I think what we envision in this powered up school is one where, students learn in museums, in parks, in libraries, in community centers, come to school, and those skills that they have acquired elsewhere are taken into account and then are expanded at the school, and that there are more partnerships between the traditional school and other institutions in the community, be they museums or parks or even, businesses can provide learning opportunities as students get older, learning opportunities that are relevant and that will provide skills that students need. So seeing that as an opportunity, I think that, the pandemic and the school closures have potentially allowed us to do things in a way that before the pandemic were kind of unheard of and very difficult to do because there was no legislation supporting it. I understand that in Colombia, for example, in the law, there is a mandate that students need to attend a school a certain number of days, and that attendance is only recognized by the law as in person. So one of the problems that regulation sometimes causes is that, look, they have been attending, but they've been attending online. They haven't met the hours because nobody can be in Zoom, forever in a day, especially not young children. It's not healthy for them. And so, I was talking to the Minister of Education of Colombia not so long ago, and she was saying, it's interesting, but we weren't prepared for this legally, And just like that, there are so many restrictions on what teachers can do, on who can teach, on what is recognized and assessed. And then valued. And I think all of these things could be changed as a result of COVID, where we perhaps shift to, more streamlined curriculum and skills requirement, but much more relevant, where we teach children not just what we think they should know, but how to be kind of drivers of their own learning process and continue to learn after school, to really understand that learning is part of life and that curiosity is actually a good thing, and not to tell them not to ask, questions. So I think there's a lot that hopefully comes out of this that will transform education. And that's what we were hoping to put in the Powered Up Schools idea, is a school that is much different from what we have had until now, and that really recognizes what we know from the learning sciences about how students learn, the diversity of learning styles, leverages technology to help the work of teachers, helps them provide more personalized instruction, helps scale up, quality instruction, helps make instruction more engaging. All these things we can do with technology. And also where other actors are helping, contributing to a student's learning process. And students, by students, I should really refer to as learners, because it's not just those young children or youth who are in school, but all of us who can continue to learn.
Do you think that the remote learning is also this answer to our previous problems?
I don't think that remote learning, especially the way it's been happening as a result of COVID, and by that I mean that it wasn't a planned strategy. Not even, Uruguay, which had for years invested in providing one laptop or a tablet for every student and in the system for, many years, was doing it to substitute in-person instruction and sort of the in-person experience of schooling. And so even in Uruguay, well, they didn't have the connectivity issues and the big digital divide that other countries had, same with Chile, they still were unprepared. And so is every country. I mean, even wealthy countries outside our region. I've spoke recently to the minister of Finland. As much as you wanted to, leverage technology, very few, especially no really K-12, right? Basic education systems were ever thought about to be fully online. It was an idea for higher education in some settings. And it was always seen as a resource to help teachers or even help parents at home and students at home. So I don't think that, the current, we call it more than remote education or even distance education, call it emergency education done remotely, because it was an emergency. Many systems closed from one day to the next. There was very little time to prepare, even in advanced countries. And I think over time and in countries that have had, the traditional summer vacation, there was some time to perhaps prepare for a better experience of remote education for students, and more knowledge, a little more experience on what works in their particular context from others. But I still think that there is so much evidence that teachers play, the most important school-side role in learning. So I think that's, to me, the promise of technology is helping unburden teachers, differentiate instruction, and helping teachers devote their time to, what they're best at, which is that interpersonal nurturing relationship, guidance that students need, and that they can also rely on the, infinite, really good quality materials that are available online. In the best of cases, I think out of COVID, we will come out with teachers who are much less afraid than they were in the past to innovate. And, I think they have been forced to innovate, and they're doing it, and they're and I think they should be recognized and encouraged to do that in the future, with parents who are much more committed to their children's own education, but also supporting the teachers and the schools, and being a resource for the learning trajectories of their kids. And I think with communities as a whole who really rely on schools to be not just like a learning place, but also a place that provides socio-emotional support, nutrition opportunities, healthcare in many cases. So kind of the value of schools as a community center is, I think, really highlighted by the pandemic. And my hope is that this will also lead to, a better recognition of the work of educators.
This is great. I'm going to close with two questions in one, and they're really tough, so I'm going to put you in the spot. Emiliana, what is keeping you up at night when you think about improving education in Latin America under these conditions? And what do you think that, let's say, what is keeping you up at night and saying, this is the opportunity. We cannot miss this aspect of this crisis as the opportunity to leap forward.
So on your first question, I think what keeps me up at night is the tremendous inequality that I'm seeing. I think that we always had inequality in the region, but that COVID is, exacerbating it. It's laid it much more bare, but it's exacerbating it. You know, some students, those of more affluent families, are attending private schools, in some sort of rhythm where they're continuing to learn. And then a great majority of poorer students are not even able to go to school, maybe not even able to access any sort of remote instruction, and are sort of in some settings, you know, as you were saying, maybe responsible for younger siblings, maybe experiencing episodes of violence at home, and other, difficult, traumatic, really, experiences, or have suffered a loved one who has, succumbed to COVID. That really keeps me up at night. And in terms of your opportunity question, what would be the one thing, you know, I would really like to see our societies in Latin America organized and demand that their leaders prioritize improving education and using education as the main tool to lift people out of poverty and growth and help economic growth. There are some exceptions, and there are some countries, I would say. I worked a lot in Chile, and I saw students protest for quality education. I saw massive social unrest demanding quality education. We don't see that in Dominican Republic, even after PISA. So, and I think the other thing that I hope is that, related to my previous anguish, is that we as Latin Americans become much more intolerant of inequality. I think for too many years, for too many decades, we have been very tolerant as a society, that some have opportunities and some don't, just based on where they're born. And I think that even if our school systems continue to improve and there's that investment in education, if our society is not more inclusive as a whole, we will not see the kinds of progress in economic development, and that it really is inclusive, and that really leads to social well-being and stability in the long term.
Thank you so much, Emiliana. I appreciated your time, and we learned a lot from you, and we hope to keep in touch. I hope to be able to catch up with you once this is a little bit more in the path.
Thank you so much, Luisa. I enjoyed the conversation, and I look forward to hopefully having some good news next time.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This podcast was produced by Elizabeth Gonzalez. This is our second episode on the pandemic's effects on education in the Americas. Check the podcast notes for a link to hear about how business schools have adapted. The music in this episode was recorded at 680 Park Ave, New York City. Find out about concerts online at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Help us spread the word. Write us a review, give us 5 stars, and subscribe on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.